This is Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck. Will bus drivers go on strike or won't they? That's been the concern of thousands of people in Chittenden County who ride city buses every day. The Chittenden County Transportation Authority and the Bus Drivers Union have been trying for months to negotiate a new contract. A strike had been threatened to begin this past Monday, and while that deadline has passed, there's concern that drivers may still walk off the job. Mark Davis is a reporter from 7 Days who's been covering the contract negotiations, and he joins me now to bring us an update. Mark, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, I understand that from the driver's perspective, the sticking point is not so much about salary or wages, but about shifts and work hours. Can you explain that?
Sure. So bus drivers don't work a normal sort of 8 to 9 hour day. A lot of them work split shifts, come in the morning and the evening, have some time off in the afternoon. Now, what CCTA says is that sort of just a necessary part of the transit business, that, you know, their peak hours are the morning and the evening commutes, and they've got to serve their customers. Bus drivers say that sort of being abused, the length of the shift, essentially the sort of the time between their first morning run and their last evening run, has been increasing, would increase again under this new contract. And they say the management really hasn't done enough to work with them to craft more sort of family-friendly schedules for their workers.
How long are their shifts?
I'm sorry?
How long are their shifts, do you know?
So the new contract would call for shifts of up to 13 and a half hours. Again, that's sort of the spread time. So they have some time off in the morning, but, you know, if you take account of a full day, it's obviously pretty difficult to sort of have a family life under those
numbers. And what other disagreements are there between the two sides?
A lot of it seems to come down to sort of matter of tone and relationship. It seems to, frankly, be a bit of a poisonous relationship between management and bus drivers. Drivers say that they're really too eager to discipline their employees for relatively minor fractions, that the break time has been cut short, that they're not really sort of consulted enough in the day-to-day operations of this company that they think they know a lot about. So it's a matter of tone, I think, in a lot of ways.
The drivers have given passengers several days' warning that a strike might begin on Monday of this week. What happened over the past weekend to prevent the strike on Monday?
So they had a bit of a marathon negotiating session over the weekend, and drivers at the end of that basically agreed to sort of hold a new vote on a new proposed contract. And so they said, okay, we won't strike on Monday. The vote is actually happening today. But a lot of drivers I talked to said they frankly plan on voting no. So this might have only been a temporary reprieve.
So do you think it's likely that there still will be a strike, rather?
I think it's possible. I'd really hesitate to speculate. I mean, it's tough talking to the parties, you know, to understand sort of what's posturing and what's real. The vote should be in later tonight. They don't necessarily have to strike. If it's a no vote, they're sort of not divulging their strategy on whether they would immediately strike or seek new negotiations. There's no real firm deadline. It's really sort of on the drivers what they want to do.
And these buses serve a lot of folks in the county, the University of Vermont, Howard Center, Fletcher Allen, plus I understand half the Burlington School District students rely on these buses. So if they do strike, how many folks, Mark, will be affected?
So they give about 10,000 rides a day, about $2.7 million a year. It's going to be a really big deal. It's going to be a pain, especially for people who can't afford to have a car. And I think we're all sort of guilty sometimes of forgetting that. But there's a lot of people who just don't have a car, and they need this for daily errands, for going to work, for anything they want to do. And CCTA has been clear that there really is sort of no backup plan here, that almost all of their service would be completely unavailable in the event of a strike. Huh. It caused some really big problems for folks.
Has Mayor Weinberger gotten involved in the negotiations or any other city officials?
Not really, no. The mayor's put out sort of a few generic statements urging the parties to settle the matter and hoping for the best, but he has not gotten involved. He sort of made a point of staying out of it.
Well, I appreciate the update. Mark Davis is a reporter from 7 Days. Mark, thank you.
Thank you.
Unlike the bus drivers with the CCTA, most of us do not work in professions represented by unions, at least not anymore. Union representation has dropped significantly in the United States in recent years. But as we just heard, when union members want to call attention to themselves, they often have very powerful ways to do it. Here to talk about the power of unions, how they developed historically, and the changing role they play today is Mark Dixon. He's a sociology professor at Dartmouth College who's written extensively on unions in the United States. Professor Dixon, great to have you on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
How far back, just historically, how far back do you have to go before the first trade unions and labor unions show up? And what were they like?
Well, I mean, we have some really early examples. You know, printers during the Revolutionary period were organized for a brief time. But we start to see the emergence of the modern labor movement during the Gilded Age, the explosion of sort of activism on the railroads. 1877, sort of a watershed year. But most of what we think about unions today comes from the New Deal era. And so we see in 1935, the Wagner Act is passed. And that's really the main law granting most private sector workers the right to organize.
And why, when you look at the Depression and the New Deal era, why is that kind of the watershed start for American unions?
Well, before that, there was no affirmative law guaranteeing the right to organize. So if employers refused to bargain with, say, a craft union, before then, the recourses for workers weren't great. And so often you saw very violent conflicts. And certainly there was all sorts of industrial unrest during the Great Depression that lawmakers were seeking some resolution to. And due to a variety of historical circumstances, the Wagner Act was the best on the table for FDR in 1935.
Listeners, if you have a question about unions and would like to join our conversation today, you can do so by calling 1-800-639-2211 or taking a historic look at unions, how they developed, what their role is today, as well as checking in and seeing how unions are represented in Rutland and the rest of Vermont, I should say. Again, you can call in at 1-800-639-2211. I'd like to ask you also about, you know, we heard at the start of the program how bus drivers in Chittenden County were upset at their working conditions. Looking back historically throughout the Depression and before that even, how have unions changed labor conditions for Americans? And can you give some specific examples of that?
Sure. I mean, unions have been pivotal in pushing for workplace safety legislation, and a lot of that comes sort of after, you know, industrial disasters like the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire in the early 19-teens. And so unions have always advocated for safety regulations on the job. A lot of that comes down to working hours, so, you know, how long can drivers drive, things like that. So a lot of those are changes that were pushed by workers and their organizations on the job and eventually got incorporated into state and federal legislation.
And you mentioned the Wagner Act just before. Can you elaborate, just kind of explain how that works and how that impacts unions today?
Sure. So, you know, the Wagner Act guarantees workers, most private sector workers, the right to organize and join unions of their own choosing. And it laid out a host of illegal or unfair labor practices on the part of employers. So, you know, you couldn't fire someone just because they said they wanted to join a union, things like that. What's notable is the Wagner Act excluded large groups of workers. So it didn't say anything about public sector workers. That was left mostly up to the states in the years that followed. Didn't say anything about agricultural workers. They were excluded, so we see that kind of vary by state. So there's a lot of missing pieces to the Wagner Act, but it gives a basic framework where unions can use the National Labor Relations Board, which was created with the act, to hold an election in a given workplace to see if workers desire representation.
Again, listeners, we're talking about unions today on Vermont Edition. You can join our conversation at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Let's go to Travin. Hi, Travin. Go ahead. You're on the program.
Thank you for having this important show. I'm my background is I was a bus driver and a truck driver for about 35 years, so I'm a retired Teamster. And I think what, you know, we're seeing today is just massive changes in the workforce and how people are treated. And frankly, things are getting a lot worse. We see that with what's happening at CCTA there, why they haven't been able to, you know, resolve a contract after, I don't know, 9 months of negotiations. And it's issues that are broad, like the part-timing of Vermont workers. They, you know, management wants to replace full-time workers with more part-timers. That's what's been happening, you know, all over the state and all over the country. You know, the increase in working hours for people so that they face fatigue issues. You know, as a driver most of my life, I know how serious an issue that is. And frankly, just the conditions, you know, how what I'll call predatory management, quite frankly, where drivers are, you know, with all the new technology, they're constantly spied on. They're threatened with suspensions for small issues of disciplinary abuse. This isn't just at CCTA. This is at United Parcel Service. It's at so many different places. Just having a livable job. Management is made, you know, changes to access to brakes. So you actually have drivers who are soiling themselves.
Trevin, I want to ask you a question. You mentioned that you were a Teamster for many years, and we're hearing that the number of union members are dropping. Unions are becoming less and less powerful, although we're seeing with the possible strike in Chittenden County that the drivers there are showing some clout. But does that concern you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we see, you know, what's happened across this country. We talk about inequality here. In this country, the massive increase in inequality and in poverty, it goes along with the drop in union density. As a truck driver, I was able to make in the 70s, wages equivalent to what a teacher, made. And today there are very, very few truck drivers that make anything really resembling a livable wage.
All right. Well, I'm gonna pick up what you've been talking about, Trevin, and throw it to our guest, Mark Dixon, to get some of his take on this. Heard a lot of concern in what he was talking about, both for the drivers in Chittenden County and his own career, and watching, the labor conditions deteriorate. What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, we've seen unions reach their peak in power in the United States in the mid-1950s, when they represented about a third of all workers. And since then, there's been a steady decline, but it really does accelerate in the 1970s and 1980s. And, you know, there's a lot of complex reasons for this, but certainly when we look at growing income inequality, the decline of unions plays not an insignificant role.
And you mentioned that I was surprised when you just said a third of American workers in the 1950s were members of unions. What's the ratio today?
Today we're looking at more, I think the latest Bureau of Labor Statistics figures are around 11.3%. So if
Wow.
you think, you know, down from 35% or so to 11.3%.
And you mentioned a lot of that deterioration occurred in the 1970s and 80s. If you look at the top several reasons for that, what would you point to?
Sure. I mean, you know, the bottom falls out in manufacturing employment in the 70s and 80s. So some of the large unions that most people probably heard of, like the United Auto Workers and the steel workers, really started hemorrhaging members during these years. And a lot of people attribute that to sort of the pressures associated with globalization. But there's a lot of other factors at play, even in industries that were somewhat insulated from globalization. We talked, you know, to our caller here, trucking saw a major decline in unionization, as did construction. And a lot of this has to do with increasing conservative opposition to and mobilization against unions. So we see some changing political circumstances that also account for some of the union decline.
Listeners, if you're just joining us, we're talking about the role of unions in Vermont and nationwide, how they've evolved, and the impact they've had on labor policy. Do you work in a union shop? What do you think when workers go on strike? Are you sympathetic? Does it make you angry? You can call us at 1-800-639-2211 and join our conversation. My guest today is Mark Dixon. He's a professor at Dartmouth College, has written extensively on the history and role of unions. Let's go to the phone now and talk to Joanna, who is calling from Burlington. Hi, Joanna. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hello. So I'm calling because I have some concerns about the recently passed Fair Share Fee Act. And I'm wondering how it is ethical or legal to pass a fee that in essence forces either union membership or paying a Fair Share Act without taking into account income equality. I think that a lot of people who are in unions, particularly part-time teachers and paraeducators, choose to not join the union, not because they don't support the union ideologically, but because they're unable to pay the fee, and I count myself in this category. So I'm just wondering if there's any movement toward lawmakers looking at that problem and trying to make the Fair Share Act fair, truly fair for people who are going to be forced to pay.
Joanna, let me pick it up. Let me pick it up for a second because I think I want to make sure listeners understand, and Mark Dixon, jump in if you need to on this. I think what Joanna is talking about is, say, with teachers, if you are not a full-time teacher and maybe you are not a member of the union, you have to pay what's called a fair share fee payment to allow you to get the teacher benefits. Is that correct? Are you familiar with that?
I'm sorry.
Mark Dixon, I'm relating this to you. Are you familiar with that, what she's talking about?
Sure. Yeah, and the logic behind it is unions are required to collectively bargain on behalf of everybody they represent. And so this allows them to do so without constantly running around and trying to convince people that it's in their best interest to pay dues. So it creates somewhat of a more stable labor relations. We've seen several states make moves against that. And so right-to-work laws essentially say unions, although you're required to collectively bargain on behalf of members, cannot negotiate contracts that compel all of them to eventually pay dues. And so that really varies across states.
And what about a sliding dues scale? I think I've heard we got some several comments that came in today from listeners about this issue, saying, as the listener we just heard from Joanna brought up, you know, maybe should there be a sliding scale if you can't afford to pay the full union dues, maybe have an income sensitive. Has that been used by any unions that you're familiar with, Mark?
I'm not sure if that's happening much today, but it's certainly an interesting proposal. And a lot of times when we see companies trying to introduce, you know, two-tiered bargaining structures where newer employees won't receive the benefits that older employees have had, maybe that might make some sense.
All right, let's take another phone call now. Let's go to Burlington and talk to Marie. Marie, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi, it's Mari Cordes. I am a proud union nurse. I work at Fletcher Allen and president of Vermont Federation of Nurses. Thanks for having this important discussion. Couple of brief comments. I think Joanna, I appreciate Joanna's question, and I think that the best place to address that issue is within the union local themselves. And we set our own, the members set our own dues structure so that there's a fair process, and not through a legislative mandate. And then just to address the culture of unionism, we agree that it's changing dramatically, and that unions many years ago used to be part of the community and often the voice of the community. And I believe there's a movement toward having that happen again because the types of workers represented by unions now are changing, a lot more service-oriented, like the drivers, like nurses, like the home care providers. So there are some very innovative ways that workers are being represented and that communities are benefiting because the people who provide these services are working really hard to make sure they have the conditions they need to provide safe and quality services. And I think community members have always come out in support of nurses and healthcare professionals mm-hmm. when we're standing strong for safe staffing.
All right, Mari, thank you for that call. I want to encourage other listeners, if you are a union member, have thoughts about unions or questions, you can join our conversation today on Vermont Edition at 1-800-639-2211 or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We will return to the phone lines, get in more of your calls, and continue this discussion just ahead. Stay with us on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck, and today we're talking about how labor unions have evolved, why their numbers are shrinking, yet why they still remain powerful in some industries. My guest is Mark Dixon. He's a sociology professor at Dartmouth College, who's written extensively on unions. I'd like to bring in another voice to this discussion. Darren Allen is with the Vermont NEA, the state's teachers union. Darren Allen, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thanks so much, Nina. Great to be here.
So do teachers have to be members of the union to teach in Vermont public schools? It sounds like from some of the comments we've just received, they don't need to be.
No, actually, no one is compelled to join a union, and it is not, for the most part, it's not a requirement anywhere to be a teacher or an educator.
And how many members of the Vermont NEA are there?
We have about 12,000, so that may sound like not a lot, but in the scale of Vermont, it makes us the largest union in the state.
Well, what about Joanna's question from Burlington? We had a write-in question wondering why there was not a sliding scale for union dues. We also heard that question posed on the air. Is there any interest in creating something like that for members?
Well, as Mari pointed out, those discussions about how dues are calculated and how they are levied are decisions that are usually made up to the members themselves. And Vermont NEA, like most of our counterparts in the other states, we have flat dues schedules for our non-licensed professionals. The education support people, their dues are roughly half of what a teacher's dues would be. And we also have provisions for if you're a part-time teacher or a part-time support professional, those dues are lower than if you're a full-time. So while we don't have it pegged to income, we do have it pegged to, you know, to whether you're full-time, part-time, quarter-time. I mean, that we even, you know, there are members who are employed in schools for only a quarter of a full-time position. So the dues are sensitive to one's, one's work category.
So I've heard from many school board members who say that while they respect and understand the need for teachers' unions, unions allow them very little flexibility in firing poorly performing teachers. Or when there are staff cuts like what's going on across Vermont right now with enrollment shrinking, that the decisions to cut various teachers are based on seniority and not based on who's the best teacher. So, Darren Allen, I'm sure you've heard that criticism before. How do you respond to it?
Well, number one, it is a real red herring that having a union and a contract, which is mutually agreed to by both sides, by the way, which school boards tend to ignore in this discussion, rather than making it difficult to address issues when a teacher or support person is not performing, it lays out a roadmap on how to either get that person to improve or, if that person can't improve, to get them out of the profession. The contract is the roadmap. The seniority-based system, which has been in place for quite some time, is a reflection of how you grow as an educator and how you grow as a teacher. A seasoned teacher has a much broader breadth of experience, and our feeling is that when you enter, you essentially rely on mentors, and you build confidence, and you build your ability to become a really good teacher. So that's where the seniority-based system has come in terms of determining who our more experienced, more seasoned teachers are, and placing a value on that in the classroom and a value in that in the workplace.
All right. Darren Allen is with the Vermont NEA, the National Education Association, which is the state's teachers union. Darren Allen, thanks for taking the time to be on the program today.
My pleasure, Nina.
Mark Dixon, public sector unions like the NEA and unions that represent state and municipal employees, the firefighters and police unions, those types of unions have remained quite strong over the years. Can you talk about why that is?
Sure. In the 50s, when unions were at their peak, public sector unions were really an afterthought, and the first state to recognize them, grant them affirmative rights, was Wisconsin in 1959. And after that, it really picks up as private sector unions start to decline. And so we saw the tail end of the civil rights years, late 60s, early 70s, lots of organizing going on amongst public sector workers. And many states during the late 60s, 70s, and into the early 80s grant public sector workers rights to organize, since that wasn't included in the national legislation in the New Deal era. And so we see the real growth for unionism in the second half of the 20th century is all in the public sector. And with that comes a real change in the composition of union members. So no longer is it, you know, maybe a white male in manufacturing in the Great Lakes states or on the coast, but it's more likely a female, maybe in teaching and nursing, things like this. So it's been a sea change for the labor movement.
Well, and how have unions affected women and minorities in the workforce?
Well, the way, you know, there's a lot of sort of labor economists, sociologists, other social scientists who try to figure out, you know, what are the wage effects of unions, and they've been very good for minorities in terms of if you're a minority worker who's a union member versus someone who looks identical who's not. The wage premium is very high. It's been a little less so for women, but it's still there.
And how about minorities?
Yeah, I mean, strong effects for unions raising wages for minorities. And you know, today black workers are more likely to be union members than white workers.
Well, I'd like to bring in another voice to our discussion. The Vermont Home Care United is one of the newer unions that we've seen come onto the scene. Audra Rondeau is a member of Vermont Home Care United, and she joins us now. Audra Rondeau, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you.
Well, we've talked about... I'm well. We've talked about some of the older and traditional unions. You are part of one of the newest unions in Vermont, which represents caregivers who work in private homes directly for families. Audra, can you describe the work that you do as a home care worker?
I work with a couple autistic girls.
And are you in their home every day or a couple times a week? Is this full time?
They're actually at my home. I have two clients, so I work 20 hours for one and 25 for another, and they come to my home.
Why did you feel, and other folks that do this kind of work, why did you feel there was a need for a union?
Because we have, at any given time, between 6,500 and 7,500 workers, and it's hard. It's hard for 7,500 people to go and say, hey, I need a union. We need a raise. We haven't had a raise in 5 years. You can't go and voice the opinion of one and make any difference.
And was wage, was salary issues, the payment issues, the main issues that you wanted to bring up with, you know, sharing numbers, having a union?
Salary issues, work conditions. Those were the two biggest concerns.
And your union is negotiating its first contract right now. How does your membership decide what to ask for in the contract? How are you holding meetings and reaching out to all the members across the state?
We actually have 20 members who are volunteering right now to get out to the rest of the members in their county. We have meetings. We send out mailings. We send out emails. We've taken surveys.
Yeah, no, I'm kind of curious, you know, your profession is so important, and I think there are so many families across the state that need this kind of work. What are some of the problems specifically that folks in this profession are up against? You mentioned salary, and that's an obvious one, but what are some of the other problems that you and others doing this face on a daily basis that unionizing might help?
Job security. Job security is a major issue. A lot of us take care of a client who has come out of the hospital after surgery, and we are employed for maybe 3 months, and then we're looking for a job again.
Go ahead.
We're hoping that if we can, you know, form together as a group, come together as a group and organize, that we can reach out to the agencies that are needing the help.
Your union was, I think, elected officials just back in November, so it's really new. But do you get a sense from talking to other folks that are now members, has this affected morale, or are you noticing any changes?
I have. People are starting to become proud of what they do. I know before that when people were asking me what I did for a job, for a living, I said I was a home care worker, and they didn't really understand the need for me. But now it's becoming more public, and people are understanding what we do for a living. We get a certain amount of respect and dignity out of it.
All right. Well, Audra Rondeau, I really appreciate you taking time to talk with me today.
Thank you.
Audra Rondeau is with the Vermont Home Care United. And again, listeners, you can join our conversation today. We're talking about unions at 1-800-639-2211. Mark Dixon, you know, we've talked about how union membership is declining nationwide, but are we also seeing new unions forming like the one we just mentioned? Is this, you know, are we also seeing different types of unions forming now?
We are. So it's an interesting period to watch labor, for sure. There's been some interesting organizing attempts that aren't quite unions. Some people are calling them alt-labor organizations. So where they might not represent workers in collective bargaining, they advocate for them in other ways. And we've seen union involvement in sort of the mounting fast food strikes over sort of living wage in the fast food industry.
Oh, sure.
We've seen growing agitation with unions over minimum wage issues. There's an interesting group called the Restaurant Opportunity Center that advocates on behalf of restaurant workers who are very underrepresented when it comes to organized labor. So there's really interesting attempts to reach out where labor might look more like, another kind of social movement or part of a coalition instead of an organization that's solely bargaining on behalf of its defined members.
All right. Well, let's go back to the phones now. Let's take a call from Anne. Hi, Anne. Welcome to the program. Anne, are you there?
So I go back to the 30s. My question is, how savvy do the union people have to be these days, union people who represent co-workers, how savvy do these people have to be with the laws and regulations that are out there? You have to be a lawyer practically these days to survive.
Huh. Mark Dixon, I'm actually, Anne, rephrase that. You're just wondering about the negotiators for the unions?
How much of the law does, say, a shop steward have to know in order to represent someone? I don't know all the workings of the union, but I'm just curious, as we've become more litigious in this age of ours.
Well, sure. Let me throw that to Mark Dixon. Talk about that for the negotiating side.
Sure. That's a great question. And I would say it doesn't come just with our litigious society of late. You can date this back to the 1940s. And so after the Taft-Hartley Act, which imposed new sets of restrictions on unions in 1947, we saw labor law grow much more complex. And as a result, union staffs expanded in size because they needed lawyers to negotiate really complex contracts with big companies. And so we started to see this pretty early on, late 40s, early 50s. But certainly a lot of negotiating today, especially with larger employers, is difficult for your average shop steward to do. And so we're talking about having, lawyers on staff.
And I'm curious, Mark Dixon, some professions are not allowed to form unions. Why is that?
A lot of it's just sort of the politics of the 30s and 40s. And so one thing that, we talked about the Wagner Act granting most private sector workers the right to organize. Who was excluded from that, or at least after Taft-Hartley in 1947, were supervisors, managerial employees. Now, that seems to make sense, but when we look at, who can be counted as a supervisor or a manager, if you're a manager at a McDonald's, does that make you unable to form a union? Well, the law says yes, whether or not you're performing things we would consider managerial duties. So there are a lot of workers that were excluded, and this was really hashed out in political fights following the New Deal.
All right. And Vicki is in the union at the Brattleboro Co-op, and she writes, in our case, the union seemed to be the only way to be assured our rights to dignified work and decent pay without the threat of being fired the next day. It's unfortunate, I think, that we need a third party to represent us as workers, but the truth of the matter is that we do. Let's take another phone call now. Let's go to Burlington and talk to Jerry. Hi, Jerry. Welcome to the program. I just ask that you make your comment or question brief.
I'll do my best. I'm long-winded. It's a very good show. I was in this auto workers, the steel workers, in a bunch of unions. And I found that the union leadership, by and large, or totally, was corrupt and paid off. I mean, in the auto workers, they were driving around with two cars, which they weren't supposed to, by law, they weren't supposed to be doing.
Hmm.
And I think the current need for unions, after Taft-Hartley and so on, has pushed people into a corner, and there is class war going on, and it's all coming down from the top.
Jerry, I'm going to jump in just because our time is short, and I want to throw your thought to Mark Dixon about corruption in unions. How are unions policed, Mark Dixon, just briefly?
Sure. There's a lot of publicity about union corruption in the 1950s, and we did see some legislation to that effect. So the Landrum-Griffin Act passed in 1959 demands financial transparency on the part of unions so that leadership can't take in excess money, things like that. Makes all these financial reports of unions public. And that comes out of the 50s. So you would say that they're much more policed today than they were in the 40s and 1950s.
Well, there's obviously a lot more to talk about, a lot more callers that wanted to get on. Listeners, this conversation will continue online. Mark Dixon is a sociology professor at Dartmouth College. He specializes in unions, has written extensively on them. Mark Dixon, thank you so much for sharing your time with us today.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
Coming up, we'll find out what's going on with this year's crazy maple sugaring season. Stay with us on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck. Now that March has rolled around, many of us are beginning to long for spring, especially on days like today. But the snow is falling heavily and more bitter cold will follow it. That means sugar makers around the state are in a waiting game. Matt Gordon is the executive director of the Vermont Maple Sugar Makers Association. Matt, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
So I know sap was flowing briefly, but not much now. What's the average time for sugar making season to begin in earnest?
Well, we're definitely getting towards the least later than we've seen lately. I've certainly heard plenty of people say we're now sort of experiencing an old fashioned Vermont winter here, where we're seeing sugaring not really get going yet. But past few years, we've definitely been started by now. Getting a little later, but nothing to be too concerned about yet.
Well, we've got our buckets up and not a whole lot's happening. But if it were suddenly going to be, say, 37 degrees tomorrow, would the sap immediately start flowing, or do you need a few days of that warmer days, colder nights type of conversion to be going on?
A little bit depends on where you are and where your trees are located. The topography really does matter. If it gets a lot of southern-facing exposure, southern exposure and a lot of sun, might start flowing quicker than, say, on the northern side where it's going to be in shadow and not warm up quite as quickly.
And what are the ideal conditions for sugar making? What is the temperature differential that sugar makers are just praying for?
Yeah, we really want to see temperatures that are getting right down into the mid-20s probably at night, and then during the day warm up into the low 40s, mid-40s. And just kind of keep a steady cycle like that. The longer we just have days where it just gets into the 40s and goes back below freezing at night and doesn't have any, see any wild spikes up into the 70s or 80s like we did in 2012. We just want that steady, slow warm up.
And if the cold does stick around for a few more weeks, would there be a negative financial impact to having a later season? How does that impact the whole season or the season as a whole?
It's really hard to say without knowing what the weather to come will look like. I mean, I guess maybe we need to get the eye in the sky team to give a long range forecast here. But it just really depends on what happens. Obviously, the longer we go, the greater likelihood that we might have a shorter season comes into play. Our season is normally about 5 weeks long, 5 or 6 weeks. So. And in the past, even last year, I think some people were still collecting sap right up until about May 1st. So we're still within tolerance, I'd say.
Well, that's good news. This year, besides juggling weather, many sugar makers are starting to use the new syrup labeling system. And I suppose this means they'll have an extra few weeks to get the new label sorted out. How much of an issue has that been for some of the folks in the industry?
Well, I don't think it's been too much of an issue because we do have this one-year grace period where you will see new labeling, new grades, but you'll also see the old labels and grades that everyone's been used to for the past couple of decades. So I think this year has really been nice to have that year of change, year of transition, so that it's not just a sudden switchover. So I think we might actually in some ways even see a few more interesting issues next year when it's going to be mandatory.
And I just wanted to remind listeners what those new labels will be like.
Sure. Well, we've changed our grades to include a flavor descriptor, so that all four grades now will have a color and a flavor. So we have golden color with delicate flavor, amber color with rich flavor, dark color with robust flavor, and very dark with strong flavor. So a little different from our previous grades.
And we've heard, that all this cold weather, there might be a silver lining, that it might postpone the progress of some invasive species that might threaten maple trees. Are sugar makers keeping an eye on that?
Sure. Obviously, as they get out in the woods, and especially later in the season when they're cleaning up, when things are a little more active, when bugs are a little more active, we'll definitely be keeping an eye elsewhere. But that is one positive of the cold weather. Just some of the invasive pests won't be quite as hopefully their populations won't be quite as big. And also just the, you know, a little delay here actually gives people more time to get out in the woods and get all the taps and everything ready. So there is a silver lining.
There's a little good news there. Well, and there was some damage, I understand, to sugaring lines in the ice storm back in December. Have people mostly recovered from that?
Most people, I think, have been able to recover. In some cases, the damage was pretty significant, so recovery was a little more slow going there, unfortunately. But by and large, I think most people, you know, were able to kind of get things back up and running. And again, another couple weeks to do so, it certainly didn't hurt them.
All right. Well, we'll all be eagerly anticipating this year's crop of maple syrup. Matt Gordon is the executive director of the Vermont Maple Sugar Makers Association. Matt, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
So two cyclists walk into a bar, and I know this sounds like I'm starting a joke, but I'm really not. They walk into the bar, and they get on stationary bikes and pedal like crazy. It's a form of racing called gold sprints, and seeing as how it's held in a bar, it's a social event as much as it is an athletic competition. VPR's Angela Evansy was at a recent race held in Burlington.
Ingredients for a gold sprints event. Two bikes, front wheels removed, set into a metal frame. The back wheels go on rollers. A little music, and an MC.
All right, everybody. Coming at you now, we're going to have Craig on your right, riding the black bike.
Hunt Manley works at Budnitz Bicycles in Burlington. He brought gold sprints to town a few years ago. Tonight's race is at the bar Arts Riot. It's part of a series called Mad Dashes.
We're going to have Chris on the left, riding the white bike. He will be red on your screen.
Gold sprints racing is both extremely intense and extremely informal. All the racers here are in jeans and sneakers, or winter boots. But when they get on stage and start madly pedaling, the competition definitely heats up.
Here we go, let's count them down from three.
Three, two, one, go!
A gold sprint is a short sprint, 250 meters. That's 0.15 miles. Since the riders aren't actually going anywhere, a computer program tracks their progress. A giant screen shows who's in the lead. The crowd can see it, but the riders can't.
All right.
And after 15 seconds, it's over. Waiting for your turn? Have a $3 switchback while Matt Boulanger sets up the next race.
These events are typically held in bars.
Boulanger is a senior planner for the town of Williston and a three-season bike commuter.
Gold sprints racing and consumption of alcohol have gone more or less hand in hand.
Note the trash can in front of the bikes in case you overdo it. Anything to beat the winter blues, right?
You know, most people who are quote-unquote seriously training probably wouldn't see it as serious training. It's more for fun and to see how fast you are against your friends and that kind of thing.
No, this is like the most ridiculous sport I've ever seen.
Eric Newberry rides with the cycling team at the University of Vermont.
I've never been to this before, and I walk in and people are just like flailing on these bikes, which is not really what you do if you're racing in a road race, but it's kind of fun to do because everyone wants to do it at heart, so.
This is also Corey Burdick's first time.
It was tougher than it looks. They said it was only 15 seconds, but it feels a lot longer.
Burdick is a runner, not a cyclist, but she still leaves with a prize like everyone else. Old Spokes Home water bottles, switchback beer koozies, artisan coffee from Maglianero Cafe. The grand prize? A nice warm helmet for winter riding of the outdoor sort. For VPR News, I'm Angela Evansy in Burlington.
And we're still getting comments about our earlier discussion on unions. Matt in Burlington writes about the Vermont Workers' Center. He says the owning class has made it increasingly difficult for workers to form traditional unions that have the right to collectively bargain. The Vermont Workers' Center has organized thousands of people through the Healthcare is a Human Right campaign. These same members are now also fighting for paid sick days and minimum wage increases this legislative session and are supporting traditionally organized workers in their struggle struggles to form their unions and win a fair contract. Another listener writes in, for the past 9 years, I've been a dedicated adjunct professor. I, as 70% to 75% of all college professors from Harvard to local community colleges, do not have union protection, health insurance, or we also never know how many classes we'll be teaching each semester. Yet, we have to pay union dues. We are the USA's new working poor. Many qualify for food stamps. And listeners, as I said before, this conversation will continue online. Just go to vpr.net and click on Vermont Edition. And that's our program for today. Tomorrow, eminent domain. Major utility projects and the interstates probably wouldn't have been built without this legal concept. We'll look at when it can be used, how compensation is determined, and the rights of the property owners in eminent domain cases. Send your questions or comments to Vermont Edition at vpr.net and listen tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Devin Karambalis. Peter Biello directed the program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen, and our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. From PEG TV Studios in Rutland, I'm Nina Keck. Thanks for listening.